Well, we're just about to the end of our review, believe it or not. So if you have your handouts from last time, I'm not going to hand any more of them out because we're almost finished, but we're just at the very end of the review handout that I handed out earlier. And we've made it through all of the historical review of the intertestamental period, and we're up to the literature of the period. So, and again, this is review. Just the first few minutes here will be review. And then we'll pick up where we left off, which was in the middle of our study of the literature of the period. So, as we said before, there was a lot of important literary developments during the intertestamental period, and we went through some of them in quite some detail, so I'll just do a very brief review of what those items were that we covered before. So the first of them was the Letter of Aristeas, which we talked about before. And that is the sort of legendary account of how the Septuagint was created in Egypt. And that's a fascinating thing to read if you're ever looking for something to read from that time period. And it tells the legendary account of how the Septuagint was translated in Alexandria. And then the Septuagint itself. So the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, of the Hebrew Scriptures, was also created during this time period. Septuagint, you may know already, is derived from a Latin word meaning 70, because traditionally 70 elders translated the Old Testament into Greek. And this happened somewhere in the time period between 250 and 150 BC. The Pentateuch, we believe, was translated early, around 250 BC. And then there's evidence that the rest of the Old Testament was completed around 150 BC. You know, we don't use the Septuagint Bible today. The Hebrew text that I believe most of our Old Testaments are based upon is the Hebrew text, which is called the Masoretic text. Oh, yes, Pastor. Yeah, so Pastor was just commenting that pastors and scholars do use the Septuagint because a lot of the New Testament quotations come from that text. And so generally, the Septuagint, when scholars compare the two, it's not as careful of a translation as the Hebrew text is, the Masoretic text. However, it is 1,000 years older than the oldest version of the Masoretic text that we have. So it's a very important document that gives us a lot of information about what was happening at that time. A translation is not only a translation, it's also an interpretation. Whenever you translate, there's interpretive things that you need to do as well. So it gives a lot of insight into the interpretation of the Old Testament Hebrew text, because they had to translate it into Greek, and when you do that, you have to interpret things, you know. So it gives a lot of insight into that. It's an ancient document relative to the oldest manuscripts of the Masoretic text that we have. And as Pastor said earlier, the majority of the quotes of the Old Testament in the New Testament come from the Septuagint. And often they're the same, and you can't really tell any difference, but sometimes, I think I was mentioning last week, that you read a quotation of the Old Testament in the New Testament sometimes, and you go, I don't remember it saying that in the Old Testament. And you go back and you look in the same Bible, it's different. And then you have to look at your little footnote that says the New Testament quotation is taken from the Septuagint version, which is not the version of the Old Testament that you have in the same Bible. So you'll often see those differences. Sometimes they're very minor, and other times they're fairly major differences in a passage where it seems quite a bit different. I'm trying to think of a good example. I can't think of one right now. Yes, Andy. Right, so you're asking about the textual tradition. Right, that excellent question. So the question is, if usually it seems like an older text would be closer to the original than a later text, so why do we think that it isn't, maybe, in this case? And I can't answer that definitively, except to the extent that scholars can tell from reading the two versions that the translation is not as careful. So they can see differences, like if they look at the Hebrew text, they could see how the translators rendered certain passages, and they can tell how careful that rendering was, assuming that the one that we have, the Masoretic text, is reliable, which it, for the most part, is. So they can tell how careful it is. Another word that they use to describe it is uneven. So it's rendered differently in different ways. I'm not a translator, so it's hard for me to give you any more than that. So the quality of the text is, in the transmission of the text down through the centuries, is even a more important criteria than its age. you can see there's a lot of detective work involved, linguistic detective work, to go back to understand what the best version is that's available. And then we have that in our English versions too, right? The same type of thinking goes into our different English versions. I've used this before, but there's a really cool visual in the back of one of my NIV Bibles. I think it's a Thompson Chain Reference Bible that I got back in the 80s. It has really cool resources in the back. And one of them is this visual depiction of the origins of our English versions. It shows the legs that go back to the original sources, including the versions that it's come through, you know, like so the ASV or whatever, some of the earlier versions, and even back in the Reformation times, you'd see where something would come from. And then the ones subsequent to that, you would see where they derive from, what were their primary things that they were deriving from. So it was a cool visual that's always stuck in my head, that it shows you that when we get a translation today, it's not like we're just sitting down with a text and just translating. There's all kinds of other considerations that go into making an English translation today. So for our purposes, one of the things to remember is the Septuagint was really the version of the Old Testament that many of the New Testament writers and people in the New Testament had available to them. And that was certainly true when we get outside of Palestine, where it's all Greek-speaking for the most part. We know, for instance, that the Septuagint version was used in synagogues as well. They weren't always just using the Hebrew text. So it's a very important development during this period of time, and it has implications down to our day for the Bible and Bible translation and interpretation. Okay, and then the other not so much particular book or writing, but a whole category of writings that developed during this period was what we called apocalyptic writings. You know what apocalypse is? Another word for revelation. Revelation is the apocalypse of St. John. Apocalyptic literature has to do with visions and judgment and looking at a future kingdom or things like that. So there was a large increase in apocalyptic literature during this period. And we looked at some of the examples of that. We just covered that as a generic category of writings that arose during this time. The final thing that we covered before the class ended last time was the Apocrypha. And so we spent, again, a good deal of time going through some of the categories of writings in the Apocrypha, as well as looking at some of the specific books in the Apocrypha. So just a couple summary points on that, since it is a very important body of literature. Apocrypha means those books that are hidden away. And that term comes from Jerome. Remember, Jerome was the one who translated the Old Testament into Latin, and the Vulgate Latin version is based on Jerome's translation. And he translated these books, but he recognized that they were not part of the Old Testament canon. And so he came up with this other category called Apocrypha and put them in a separate section in his translation. So he distinguished them from the canonical books in that way. The Apocrypha was written in our time period here, roughly between 200 BC and 100 AD are the dates of the Apocrypha. There's 15 books, and it's 15 or 14 or 13, depending on how you categorize things. Sometimes they put some of them together, but there's 15 individual writings in the Apocrypha. And you'll notice, too, that some of them are fragments or additions to other books. So there's additions to Esther, for instance, in the Apocrypha. And so if you have Bibles that are more from the Protestant tradition, like from the Anglican or Lutheran traditions, you'll often find all of the Apocrypha books are put in between the two Testaments. So you have Old Testament, Apocrypha, New Testament. And then other Bibles, you'll find that they actually try to put the text where it goes in the Old Testament. So you'll find these additions to Esther and Esther. Some of them are actually interspersed in the book. I think some of the additions to Daniel are that way, where they're actually additions to certain chapters and things in the book. So if you have a Bible that has the Apocrypha in it, it won't necessarily just be all in the middle. It might be scattered about. But there were a number of different types of literature in the Apocrypha, historical. We've used the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees extensively in our class here as a historical source. Those are good examples of historical books. There's also wisdom literature. There's legendary material. And then there's also prophetic and apocalyptic literature in here. So those are sort of the main categories that we find. And then just to close with the discussion of that, the Roman Catholics, of course, have this as part of the canon. The Council of Trent gave most of these books, I think with the exception of three of them, canonical authority. And I think the term that they used is deuterocanonical, so second canon. But it is part of the canon, and it has authority in the Church. And I won't go through all of the responses to that we went through before, but I will read the Confession. So the Westminster Confession has a comment on the Apocrypha in Chapter 1, Section 3, and it goes like this. The books, commonly called Apocrypha, not being of divine inspiration, are no part of the canon of the Scripture, and therefore are of no authority in the Church of God, nor to be any otherwise approved or made use of than other human writings. So that's a good summation of the Protestant view of the Apocrypha. Now, that doesn't mean that the Apocrypha isn't extremely valuable to us. I mean, matter of fact, a lot of the reformers have made comments on the value of the Apocrypha. And just to sum that up, first of all, it gives a lot of information about the intertestamental period. So there's a lot of historical value to the Apocrypha. There's also a lot of interpretive value. Again, it gives us early glimpses of the thinking of the day. And then the final thing I wanted to say is that if you wanted to sum this up, it really could be categorized as edifying wisdom in fiction literature. If you read through it, it's actually good literature, and it can be edifying. There's a lot of good things in the Apocrypha. So if you ever have a chance to read some of those books, it is a valuable thing to do. So that's basically where we got to in the class. So are there any questions up to this point before we delve into the new material? When I say where we got to in the class, a year ago. Any questions? Okay. So we'll pick up here with the literature, and we've really got three topics left under literature. Yeah. Thank you for that. You can get all worked up about this, and Pastor made a good point earlier about the inspiration and the text that we have confidence and assurance that it is the Word of God. And so all these secondary means that were used to create the Bible are all under His authority, all under His direction, and that gives us great confidence. And that really goes for this whole intertestamental period. You know, it's just been a wild ride, you know, all kinds of wild things going on, and it's sometimes hard to see the providential hand in that, but we know it was there, and I was talking to Ginny the other day about this, how it all was leading up to the birth of our Savior. All of this is setting up the context for Jesus coming, and that's how we'll end the class, you know, later this semester, but it is good to remind ourselves that even though things look really out of control, God is in control of all of this. And that's a lesson for today, too, when we see many parallels in our own culture to the things that we're seeing in the intertestamental period. Okay, so the next group of literature that we're going to take a look at here is called the pseudepigrapha. And if you think that there's odd things in the Apocrypha, there's odder things in this body of writing. Think of Bell and the Dragon and things like that. There's some weird things here. So this is another broad category of writings, and there's a lot of overlap in the way people categorize these books, and we'll look at some of that. But even for the term Apocrypha, sometimes the term Apocrypha isn't used to refer to those 15 books that we were just talking about. It's a broader category that might even include a lot of these books that we're getting ready to talk about. So just keep that in mind. These aren't hard and fast distinctions sometimes. But pseudepigrapha, you can hear from the word, pseuda, that these are false inscriptions. What that means is that they're writings that have a pseudonym attached to them, typically of someone famous who somebody might recognize so that people are interested in reading them. So there's more than 60 of these titles, and there's many more of these books that did not survive. We know about them because the church fathers, for instance, quote other books of these that we don't have, that are no longer extant, so we don't have copies of them. But we know that they existed. So some of them are true pseudepigraphs. That means they have someone's name attached to them. One example would be Enoch, or First Enoch, it's sometimes called. The Apocalypse of Baruch. So Baruch being the scribe that was attached to Jeremiah. The Testament of the 12 Patriarchs. Things like that would be considered true pseudepigraphs, or pseudonymous books. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. Some of them are not true pseudepigraphs. Like in this body, we have 3rd and 4th Maccabees, and those are not considered pseudepigraphs. And then on the other side of the coin, some of the books in the Apocrypha are also pseudepigraphs, so they would fall into this category, like the Wisdom of Solomon, 2nd Ezra, which is Ezra, the Letter of Jeremiah. So you can see those are pseudepigraphs, and they're in the Apocrypha. And one other thing to note, we talked a little bit about this more with the Apocrypha, but none of these works were included in the Greek translation of the Old Testament. And the general time frame here is similar to the Apocrypha. We're talking 200 BC, roughly, a little further to 200 AD, or when these books were written and being written. So what are some examples of these guys? We've got the Letter of Aristeas, which we've talked about a number of times already. So 3 and 4 Maccabees. 3 Maccabees is a legendary account of some of the episodes that happened during the reign of one of the Ptolemy rulers, Ptolemy IV, in Egypt. And interestingly, it's not at all related to 1st or 2nd Maccabees or the Maccabees at all. It's not related to the revolt or anything like that. But likely this book was written as an apologetic for conservative Judaism. So one of the things you'll note in some of these books is that there's definitely an apologetic thrust to them. That's the reason that they were written, if you will. And then 4 Maccabees, written in the same time frame. This one is written in the form of a synagogue sermon. So the author is using a synagogue sermon as the literary device to deliver his message. Likely written by an Alexandrian Jew with a Pharisaical viewpoint, which would mean like an emphasis on the law, the Old Testament law. And this one is related to the Maccabee period. It describes the sufferings and the martyrdom of Jewish heroes during the Maccabean period, which would be an expansion of the material that you find in 2nd Maccabees. This one is more of a philosophical work, which you might expect if it's written by an Alexandrian Jew, but it's a philosophical work showing that the Jewish religion was not incompatible with Greek philosophy, but rather it's the true philosophy. And there was a lot of that going on in this period. Moses was actually a famous person to the Greek philosophers working in the Jewish context. He was seen as one of the great philosophers, and there was a lot of activity going on to try to marry up the teachings of Moses and the teachings of the Greek philosophers. And we find that, for instance, in Philo, who we talked about last week. But you can see here, again, the apologetic thrust. You have an Alexandrian Jew trying to show that Judaism is compatible with the Greek culture around us, and trying to show that Judaism is really the true philosophy. And they're related. When the Greek philosophers are figuring things out, you can see ties to the Jewish philosophy. Dave, did you want to say something? Yeah, so not incompatible is what I meant to say. Because there was a lot of intellectual pressure in the Greek culture to accommodate to Greek philosophy, and we see the Apostle Paul dealing with that in the book of Acts, as well as in some of his epistles. So that's 4 Maccabees. Then we have Enoch. This is sometimes called 1st Enoch. This is an apocalypse, and it's actually composed of 5 different books, probably 5 different authors as well, even though it's gathered under one writing. This one is interesting because it contains some very early messianic interpretations. The term Christ is applied to a coming messianic king for the first time in Jewish literature in this book. So that's noteworthy in itself. But then also another interesting thing is that this book uses the title Son of Man as a messianic title. And we see Jesus using that when he comes on the scene. But this is an earlier writing, somewhere between 170 and 64 BC. Several other titles and ideas of the Messiah are mentioned in this book that are found in the New Testament, which has led scholars to speculate that the New Testament writers may have been influenced by this writing in applying certain messianic categories to Jesus, which is interesting to me because we were just talking earlier about inspiration and how God uses the experiences and the knowledge of the human authors to write things. So they're bringing in this experience that they have. And in some cases, you know, like in the Gospel of John, for instance, there's a lot of debate about how he may have been influenced in his use of the term logos for Christ, you know, the word. It's just counteracting the dictation theory or the theory that the writers were just getting a lightning bolt and writing and words were coming out. Is that the organic inspiration? Is that the term that's used for that, Greg?
You mean for
the fact that... I wasn't sure about that, but I think that's the organic aspect of inspiration, that God is using the human knowledge and experience of the writers to write his very words. So this is a very interesting book, a very significant book in New Testament studies. And then we have the Ascension of Isaiah. This is one that comes a little later in the 1st or 2nd century AD, and it's a mixture of Jewish and Christian elements that you might expect if you have a writing that's that late in the Christian era. One of the sections describes Isaiah's travels through the seven heavens. But something that's interesting here is that this is the book, there's actually one other one as well, but this is the book that contains the legend about Isaiah being sawed in half during the reign of Manasseh. So, you know, you've probably heard that, may have wondered where it came from. It's from this book, and then there's another parallel book around the same era. So this is where we have the tradition that Isaiah was martyred under the reign of Manasseh. Okay, so what do we do with all this? What's the value of these books? Well, you can tell from the apologetic thrust that we talked about. Oh, yeah, Daniel, you have... Yeah, that's an excellent point. So the book of Hebrews refers to prophets that were sawn in two, which I think likely is referring to Isaiah. We're not sure about that because it doesn't mention Isaiah's name in that text, but I've always interpreted it as pointing to Isaiah. So tradition, you know, we have tradition for many things that we believe have actually happened, but, you know, we don't have 100% conclusive evidence that it did. You could say the same thing about the book of Aristeas, which has the account of the Septuagint being translated. It's legendary from the sense that there's probably embellishments in there, but it's probably based on actual historical thing that happened in Alexandria with Jewish scholars, for instance. And I think we have the same thing here. This book is really legendary. The Ascension of Isaiah is a legendary book. There's mythological elements in this book. So we call it legendary, but there's probably a historical basis for some of the things that we read in there. So it's kind of in the same category. Yes, Bill. That book has connections between the term Son of Man and applying it in a messianic way. Yeah, this is a difficult topic. We are going to talk about it when we get into the New Testament era here in several weeks, I guess. But the whole messianic concept, I mean, there's reams and reams of scholarly debate about this and books and things like that, about how the messianic concepts developed over the centuries. Then Jesus applied them to himself. And then other New Testament writers after him applied them to Jesus. But there's a lot of debate. I mean, you've probably wondered the same things. Like, when Jesus talks about all these things being written about him, what is he talking about, right? And so we have to go back to the Old Testament. And then we have a lot of insight into that because the New Testament quotes passages from the Old Testament and applies them to Jesus. Some that we would have never applied to Jesus, you know, just reading on a first reading of the Old Testament. So the Son of Man comes from Daniel, right? And there's a lot of debate. Is that a messianic use of the term in Daniel? And I believe the consensus is it probably wasn't at the time. But then Jesus picks up that imagery and clearly applies it to himself. It's how much are you reading back now that you have more revelation versus what is developing during the intertestamental period in terms of these ideas about the Messiah. What is the Messiah going to be? Is it going to be a political ruler? Is it going to be one person? Is it going to be multiple people? There's all those ideas that we'll get to. Well, we won't completely unpack that, but we'll touch on it. Now you're going off on another topic there. What does fulfillment mean in the New Testament? There's different senses in which the Old Testament was fulfilled. That is like an example where people debate on, well, not debate, but there's different ways of fulfilling something. One of my seminary professors, Richard Pratt, has done a lot of work on this, on how the New Testament writers view fulfillment of Old Testament passages. And they have different categories of what fulfillment means. And as a matter of fact, on this passage, I believe Stephen Michaud preached a sermon on this here a while back, maybe this year. think it was before the sabbatical, but I believe he preached on that passage, and he gave a helpful introduction, I believe, to what fulfillment means. So you could probably look that sermon up or ask Stephen about it. But yeah, there's a lot of literature on this. Very fascinating subject, how the New Testament writers use the Old Testament under the inspiration of the Spirit. So very interesting stuff. Yes, Ginny. Jude does refer to Enoch. There are some interesting things in the New Testament where people refer to things like Enoch. And even earlier there, in verse 9, we read about the dispute with the devil about the body of Moses. And that is, I believe, from the Assumption of Moses, which is an intertestamental period book as well, I believe. So, yeah, Jude was quoting from some of this literature. You know, they had this literature available to them. Yes? Oh, verse 9 is the Assumption of Moses. Verse 14 is the question, is that the same Enoch as the Book of Enoch? Does it say it's from 1st Enoch? Oh, there you go. Yes. According to the Reformation Study Bible. Yes, Daniel. Yeah, there's a lot of debate about that. He definitely applies that to himself in that sense when he says, you will see, I believe at Jesus' trial, he uses it in that sense. Daniel says, the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. And I think Jesus says something like, see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Father or something. I think I'm butchering that. But that statement is what caused the priests to get, you know, we've heard enough. Let's take him out. We've heard enough blasphemy. So they recognize that he was using it in the sense of quoting Daniel at that point. We talked about the desire to maintain Jewish identity in a growing pagan environment. And so in these books, you'll find a lot of anti-pagan themes and then an emphasis on the imminent coming of God's judgment. And that's kind of the apocalyptic sense of it. And we'll see that more in the next section on the Dead Sea Scrolls. But the pseudepigrapha provide important information on Judaism of this period. Again, it gives us a lot of insight into the thinking of the Jews who were writing at this time. And it doesn't present a unified picture of a uniformity of thought, if you will. The books themselves often present the viewpoint of a specific group or individual. And so what we see emerging here is the divergent views within Judaism. Although there's obviously always a core orthodoxy within Judaism, we start to see the divergent views apparent in some of these writings. So why the increase of the use of pseudonyms at this point in time? Well, the same reason that we saw an increase in apocalyptic literature at this time, it was because there were no true prophets speaking the word of God in the intertestamental period. So there was this hunger to have some word from God. And so the pseudonyms were chosen by authors to lend credibility to their writings at a time when there wasn't a true prophet, to gain acceptance of what they were trying to teach. I mentioned before that the contents of these documents are often legendary. You might even say fanciful in a lot of them. Some of them definitely read like mythology rather than history. And then strong apocalyptic themes, we mentioned this before, and this, again, was a desire to explain the relation between the final Old Testament prophecies, which had ceased now, and the current state of affairs in the intertestamental period, which things were quite out of whack. And so there was a desire to try to understand and relate the final Old Testament prophecies to what I'm seeing in the world around me right now. And so this apocalyptic literature arose as a result of that. Eschatological interpretations developed to try to explain the current struggles that they viewed as struggles between good and evil. And so you see the light and darkness themes in some of the apocalyptic writings of this time period. And then we see a rise in messianic themes, which we were just talking about. And we'll talk some about this later, but messianic themes in an idealized sense, not necessarily personalized, not necessarily applying to an individual, and definitely focused on the coming of an earthly kingdom. So that seemed to be one of the expectations that people had about Messiah, whatever that meant to them. And then the Qumran community, this is the area near the Dead Sea that possibly was related to the Essenes, the branch of Judaism called the Essenes. They used a lot of these works. We find evidence a lot of these works there, particularly some of the apocalyptic writings. And we know that the Qumran community followed the Jewish calendar in 1st Enoch, which is different from the one that was followed in Jerusalem. And then I guess for this section, I just wanted to read a quote from one of the scholars on this time period, R.H. Charles, kind of sums up the pseudepigrapha as well as the apocrypha books at this time. It's probably a good way to end here today. So this is relating to the value of this literature to us today. This is what Charles says. No attempt to study Christianity and its origins can dispense with a knowledge of this literature. If we wish to reconstruct the world of ideas and aspirations which filled the heart of an earnest Jew at the beginning of the Christian era, it is to this literature that we must have recourse for our materials. Although in its higher aspects Christianity infinitely transcends the Judaism that preceded it, yet in others it is a genuine historical development from such Judaism. Christianity came forth from the bosom of Pharisaic Judaism, and in apocalyptic literature this form of Judaism found its essential utterance. Thus, Jewish apocalypses not only supply a history of religious beliefs in the two pre-Christian centuries, but they also fill up the otherwise unavoidable gap in the history of Jewish thought and constitute the living link between the prophetic teachings and ideals of the Old Testament and their fulfillment in Christianity. So you see there that this literature bridges that gap that we find, and that's hopefully something that's been useful to us as we look at this literature.